Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. Hey, if you're a regular listener, you know that I don't like quick, superficial interviews. We like to dig in a bit. We usually have a little intro. We make fun of some people, and then we have three guests on for about 15 minutes each. But this week, we have two really in-depth, good in-depth conversations. And it's really not going to leave us any time for the usual introductory spiel. So first, we're going to speak with David Dayan about his new book, Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. It's a good book. It's a little bit of a detective book. And of course, it's going to get us up to date on the foreclosure crisis, which never came to an end. That's a key point. Then we'll be joined by Politics and Reality Radio senior Middle East correspondent Ali Gharib. And he and I will talk about liberal Islam, obviously not a threat in the same way that violent right-wing Islamists may be. So we're going to take a quick break and then jump right in. Stay tuned.
Did you read the news? I'm a bit confused. The gun fever is bad, the gun fever. Rudeness and gun is the talk of this town. The gun fever is bad, the gun fever.
Every time you read a clean or a star, this man shot dead or who gang at war.
It's the fever, oh, the gun fever.
The simplest thing is blam, blam, blam. What is this in all little island?
It's the fever, oh, the gun fever. You can know a rude chap by the way he said his cap. Lord, the gun fever is bad, the gun fever. The rude dog is seen, Lord, I don't know what it means. The gun fever is bad.
Time you read a clean or a star, this man shot dead or root gang at war.
It's the fever, oh, the gun fever.
The simplest thing is blam, blam, blam. What is this in all little island?
It's the fever, oh, the gun fever.
Welcome back to the show. I'm really pleased to be joined by David Dayan. He's an excellent journalist. He writes for a number of outlets. You can read him at Salon or The American Prospect, at The Intercept, and elsewhere. And he's the author of a blood-boiling new book, I would say, titled Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. David, welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio.
All right. Thanks for having me, Josh.
So last month, the New York Times had this report. It was about how squatters have descended on every corner of Las Vegas, taking over empty houses. Mm-hmm. They said that it was happening in struggling neighborhoods, in upscale neighborhoods, and that some of them were families that were, you know, they needed a place to stay. But a lot of them were like criminal gangs, and they were selling drugs and stuff like that. And the thing that struck me about this story was that I realize that it's pretty rare to see stories like that these days. A few years ago, we would constantly hear about the foreclosure crisis. David, where are we at in that crisis? And do you think that there's a sense of scandal fatigue has set in among the public?
There's no question. They even have a name for it, foreclosure fatigue, that has set in. And it's not just among the public. It's not just among the media. It's among the judges that are charged with dealing with foreclosure cases in all of these different jurisdictions. So that is a tremendous problem. As far as where we're at, foreclosure starts, new foreclosures have been going down. That's largely because the loans that have been generated in the last several years have been of pretty good quality. Most of the foreclosures that are still working their way through the system, incredibly, are legacy loans from the housing bubble from 2005, 2006, 2007, 2008. It's amazing that we're still dealing with these, but one of the reasons we are is because of this thing I talk about in my book, which is the failure to maintain the proper ownership documents and the transfers of ownership throughout the loan process, and the kind of ham-handed ways that were used to mock up these documents to try to prove that these mortgage companies had standing to foreclose. So because that has been such a protracted process, the most of the foreclosure litigation that we're seeing right now still dates back to that era.
All right. And, you know, I think a lot of listeners have a sense of that story of how the chain was broken between mortgages. But can you just give us a little brief summary in case people haven't been paying attention?
Absolutely. So when what we're talking about is kind of where The Big Short left off. Many of us saw The Big Short or read the book, and we know that there was this thing called securitization where these loans were originated, immediately sold to an investment bank, put through a number of different transactions, put into a trust, and then that trust would generate these mortgage-backed securities that were purchased by investors all over the world. So we know about that. What we come to find out through the course of my story is that when that process was undertaken, the very precise steps of property records law to actually document each and every one of those transfers and maintain the chain of title, which is the chain of ownership that goes from one entity to another, but you're supposed to be able to go to a public office and go all the way back to the moment that property was constructed and see who owned that property at every link along the chain. This was not followed. This was simply not done. And I guess that would have been fine if everyone paid their mortgages and then that paper would be extinguished. The problem is that we had a housing bubble and a collapse, and millions of people went into default on their loans. And at that point, the lenders needed to have documented proof that they actually owned this loan and had the right to enforce the foreclosure. And because of this break in the chain of title, they didn't have that evidence. And so what they did is they mocked it up, either through third parties or their own law firms or even themselves. However they did it, they fabricated documents and used them as evidence in courts on a mass systematic scale. And that's really what my main subjects in this book, which is told through the lens of three foreclosure victims, come to find out.
And this is a really key point, because if I represent that a document has been signed by such and such person and I take it to a court and I present it as evidence, that's fraud, right? That's criminal fraud. We had William K. Black on the show. He prosecuted hundreds of Wall Street executives during the savings and loan crises, and he estimated that there were over 2 million fraudulent loans issued in 2006 alone based on liars' loans. And then they built this house of cards on top of those loans, and they had all these fraudulent warranties and fraudulent paperwork as they collateralized that debt. Now, I still encounter some people out there who are not sure crimes were committed. Does that just boggle your mind, or have you encountered these types of people?
I mean, in some kind of way, that's why I wrote the book. It was kind of a book-long refutation of this story, sometimes told by officials in the Obama administration, by the way, what was done on Wall Street was unethical, but it wasn't really illegal, and we didn't have good cases to make, and juries just wouldn't understand. It was too complex. That's really what my book tries to break down. Here were three ordinary people who were put into foreclosure, who did more investigation of the subject than the people whose job it was to do it, the state and the federal law enforcement apparatus. And then they delivered this information on a silver platter to those figures of authority. And it was very obvious information. You're talking about fraud upon state courts. You're talking about the use of false evidence that was doctored, that was fabricated, that was forged. At a systemic mass scale, you're talking about millions of documents, millions of pieces of evidence implicating every major bank in this country. And the idea that a jury wouldn't get forgery and fraud of this nature is kind of ludicrous. And the idea that this wasn't a criminal action is also ludicrous. And so it's kind of that my book was one of the reasons that I wrote it was that to say we have this alternate history. We could have gotten accountability for the financial crisis and the aftermath. We had the evidence. We had the information. We had the way to connect it all together. And we need to reckon with the fact that our representatives in state and federal law enforcement just didn't do it.
I'm gonna get to your book in a second. I think that some of this background is important, though. So in the 80s, right, Wall Street made big donations to politicians. They lobbied, right? There was a revolving door between financial corporations and regulators, and yet top officials went to prison. So the question of why nobody high up has been held accountable for this really egregious case of consumer fraud that brought the whole economy crashing down, it has to be more complicated than just like money in politics, doesn't it? I mean, what else is going on?
Well, I think that the book tries to raise that question of what is going on. I think that unanswered question explains a lot of the frustration and anxiety that is playing out in our politics today. I mean, we had this huge, great recession, the biggest in 80 years. And at least people seem to think that there was a pretty clear culprit for why that recession took place. And yet they didn't feel like they got the kind of accountability and justice that they wanted to in the aftermath. And so I really think that you can draw a direct through line between that circumstance and all of this kind of angry politics that we've seen. And so what is the motivating factor for why Wall Street didn't go to jail? You can throw out a few possibilities. I mean, Eric Holder certainly seemed to not want to bring cases forward unless he knew ahead of time that he was going to be successful. You can definitely say that there was a time in the administration where they were very wary of anything that would have an impact on bank balance sheets, and that homeowner balance sheets were sort of pushed to one side. You know, there's certainly evidence for all of those cases. I can't say it was X, Y, and Z definitively. I can just tell you what happened. And what happened is that we had the evidence. There were even officials like U.S. attorneys and FBI agents and state attorney, career prosecutors in the offices of state attorneys general. And I talk about all of them in my book who were willing to follow this evidence where it led and go up the chain like you would in any other criminal case and implicate whoever was responsible. And for whatever reason, every single one of them was stonewalled by people in a position of authority over them. And so when you see this over and over and over again, you start to wonder, you know, who is directing this scheme and why do we have what seems like a two-tiered system of justice and why is who you are more important than what you did in the criminal justice system? And I think it's something, you know, I think it's something we have to get to the bottom of. And hopefully my book could spur that in a small way.
Folks, I told you that this was a book that would make your blood boil. And I really want to stress this point, right? There is widespread distrust in our institutions across the board. I think David is entirely right that the lack of accountability for the financial crisis, for this widespread fraud on Wall Street is not solely responsible, but certainly is a big part of it. Now, and people who had done everything right and made their mortgage payments face foreclosure. How did that work, David?
Well, when you had this kind of chaotic system where nobody really knew who owned what, and the people who were sort of enforcing and implementing this, what I call the great, you know, the great foreclosure machine in the book, The people who were doing it were at such a sort of low level and had their own financial interests at heart that you saw just tons of mistakes. You know, people getting foreclosure notices when they paid cash on the home, or people getting foreclosure notices when they were short 2 cents on a monthly payment. And then that would just sort of pyramid, and there were late fees added onto that, and then finally they were put into foreclosure. Or people getting two notices of foreclosure from different companies, each of them claiming to have a true and correct copy of the promissory note and the mortgage. This happened repeatedly during this period of, from 2009, 2010, 2011, all throughout that period up to the present day. We're seeing cases like this. And what you have to sort of reckon with and understand is that we had this fundamental rupture in this, you know, property records law, which goes back to the 1630s in America. That's 150 years before we had a constitution. We had property records law, and we thought it was important enough that it had to be public. It had to be deliberate. It had to be, you know, documented pieces of paper that said, I am turning this property over to this person or this entity. And we did that because it's kind of one of the building blocks of a society, a developed society. The idea that you can buy and sell property with the confidence that no one else has a claim on it. You know, when you go to your closing and you sign all those papers and get all those disclosures for your mortgage, it's the biggest, you know, purchase that you're going to make in your life. And all of those papers at closing are designed to give you confidence that this system is correct, it's proper, there are double checks, and you're not going to be in a situation where you do everything right and still come out short. And that is really that sort of trust, that trust between you and that industry was broken during this period. And that really is the fundamental problem that my main characters in the book really, you know, are faced with.
If you're just tuning in, this is Joshua Holland, and I'm speaking with David Dayan about his new book, Chain of Title. And in the book, and before I go on, I should say, just for the sake of disclosure, that I'm like three quarters of the way through it. It's a super busy time, as you might guess, and I'm going to finish it over the weekend. But David really paints the picture of this like huge foreclosure machine. It was like the one growth industry in the middle of the recession, and there were things like these garbage service. Is that what was it? Garbage service?
Sewer service.
They're so, and these people, these low level lackeys at the bottom level of this machine were so, they had to face so much grief and frustration that they just throw the service on the lawn, and then the people would not notice it and not show up in court. Right. Things like this are just unbelievably maddening. So you chose to look at a large national issue through the lens of these three whistleblowers. They weren't fraud investigators. They're ordinary people, basically, right?
Yes. Yeah. So it takes place in Florida, where you see, you know, I mean, Florida is kind of the home of small-time corruption. I read a lot of Carl Hiaasen.
Yes.
To prepare for this book, because it's similar kind of things going on. And I really wanted to look at this crisis from the ground level of the people who are most powerfully affected by the financial crisis, and that's homeowners. You know, we had the best statistic is 6.2 million foreclosures between September 2008 and today. That's probably closer to 10 million people. And that doesn't even count people who did short sales or who just surrendered their homes. So you're talking about millions and millions of people. I actually saw I was on a study yesterday by the MacArthur Foundation, and they said that over the last 5 years, their respondents said that one in three of them knew someone who was either foreclosed on, surrendered their home, or was evicted. So this touched so many people in American life, and yet these stories are kind of invisible. We just don't hear much about them, both in the culture and certainly in policy. I mean, the foreclosed homeowners don't have a lobby. They're not first in line here.
Right.
So what I wanted to do is really tell their story. And, you know, I found these three people in Florida. Lisa Epstein was a cancer nurse. Michael Redman was an auto salesman. And Lynn Simoniak was a lawyer, but she was involved in white-collar crime of a different color. It was around insurance fraud and workers' comp fraud. And these three people all were put into foreclosure for various different reasons. And they committed a revolutionary act. They read their own documents when they received them. And in reading those documents, they found these irregularities, and they used them not only to fight their own cases, but they decided, really got obsessed and decided to look for patterns throughout the state and throughout the country, and found them, and then found each other in the comment sections of websites. And sort of made a pact with one another that they were going to expose this to the country, that they were going to do whatever needed to be done in order to make sure the entire nation knew what Wall Street was up to with these false documents being presented as evidence in court cases all over the country. And so that's really where the story takes off.
And just to tease listeners and give them a sense that this is not a dry book, there is kind of like an Aaron Brockovich kind of thing about David's narrative, right? So you're following these people as they learn things and also as they stir up trouble, and it's a compelling story. So it's not a dry like nonfiction book about, oh, here's what happened in the foreclosure crisis. It's actually a pretty compelling read. David, tell me this. What does control fraud mean?
Well, that's a term that I think Bill Black, who I was honored that he actually blurbed my book, popularized. And control fraud really refers to the fraud being, you know, it's kind of like the call is coming from inside the house. The fraud is coming at the direction of the executive officers of, in this case, a financial institution.
What does moral hazard mean?
So moral hazard refers to this idea that if you assist an entity, whether it's a homeowner or a financial institution, that they now have no real impetus to change their ways, and they're just going to be expecting that assistance over and over and over again. And interestingly, during the crisis, moral hazard was used to describe homeowners, that we can't help irresponsible, quote unquote, homeowners with their loan problems, or else they're just going to go ahead and continue to be irresponsible. Moral hazard was very rarely applied to the fact that banks were bailed out in 2008 without many consequences. So the idea that they could, you know, continue their ways. And it was kind of what I described in the book eventually is sort of a rolling bailout, because they committed this foreclosure fraud repeatedly, and they got off with, a small-time settlement that was far less than even advertised, and certainly nothing along the scale of the actual legal exposure they faced if they couldn't actually foreclose on millions and millions of loans. So interestingly, during the crisis, we never saw moral hazard really apply to banks, but it was always brought up in the case, from the standpoint of homeowners.
And the reason that I ask those questions is that it's really important for people to understand the importance of not saying, oh, let's look forward and not look behind, right? Because
yes,
these people made billions of dollars, and the fact that they were not held accountable for the damage that they did incentivizes them to come up with the next scheme.
Right.
And we've seen that with auto loan securitization and
yep.
Right. So when you don't punish people, and it's a basic theory of law enforcement, right? If I were to go in and steal radio out of a car, get caught, and nothing happens to me, well, you know what? I'm going to go steal another radio out of another car. And this is really, really the key issue here. It's not about vengeance, right? It's not about vengeance.
It's about deterrence.
It's about deterrence and the rule of law.
Yeah, and more than anything, the rule of law, because what you're talking about is false evidence. I mean, in any other court context, if false evidence was used to try to convict a defendant, that case gets thrown out almost unilaterally. It's only in this foreclosure law that we had this false evidence, but judges sort of weigh that against, well, what would happen if I give this homeowner who might not have paid a mortgage payment a free house? And the way I always describe it is, you know, if you saying that it doesn't matter who actually owns the mortgage, as long as there's a borrower that failed to pay, is kind of like saying, you know, it doesn't, as long as there's a criminal suspect who we think is guilty of murder, it's okay for the cops to plant a gun on him. It's really a perversion of the rule of law and the integrity of the criminal justice system. And that's what we've seen and what we're continuing to see over and over again, because every day in America, somebody continues to be thrown out of their home based on a false document. And the legal community and certainly the political community has just walked away from the field and kind of pretends it doesn't happen.
Now, David, before I let you go, and I've taken more time than I said that I would, so I apologize for that.
No problem.
But I want to bring this whole issue up to date with the latest. You wrote a piece that was published on Friday by The Intercept titled "Mortgage Companies Seek Time Travelers to Find Missing Documents." This is about how they're trying to patch together that chain.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about your latest before we let you go.
It's really interesting. So I write this book called Chain of Title. And then within a few weeks, we start seeing these job listings at mortgage servicing companies for, quote, chain of title specialists to fix the chain of title on these various documents. Now, this is what they were doing. You know, this is the conduct sort of in my book that they were doing for years. And we had a settlement over these activities because they were deemed, you know, illegal. And
right.
In the settlement, you would assume that the activity, the misconduct that is being settled, actually stops. But here we have these job listings for someone to go around and redo the chain of title on all of these loans. I mean, the problem is that once you break the chain of title, it's very hard to unbreak it, at least legally it is. It's kind of irreparable. I mean, the way in which these securitizations were put together, there were trusts that were supposed to hold the governing documents. And once those mortgages weren't put into the trust after the closing date of the trust, that's it. I mean, under the governing laws and the securitization agreements, you don't get a second chance. Once the 90-day window or however long the window is, once that closes, it's kind of over. And so when you're advertising as a mortgage servicing company for a chain of title specialist, what you're really advertising for is a specialist in doctoring documents. And it just shows that we're still at this years and years after the end of the financial crisis and years after this activity was supposedly done away with.
Folks, check out that piece at intercept.com. David Dayan's book is Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. It's a really good read. It's not dry. Pick that up at your local bookseller. It's about people. David, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Josh, thanks.
Folks, stay tuned. We'll take a quick break and then be right back with Ali Gharib.
Quando as coisas do coração não consegue compreender e a mente não faz questão e nem tem forças pra obedecer. Quantos sonhos já destruí e deixei escapar das mãos. Se o futuro assim permitir, não pretendo viver em vão. Meu amor, não estamos sós. Tem um mundo a esperar por nós. No infinito do céu azul, pode ter vida em Marte. Então vem cá, me dá a sua língua. Então vem, eu quero abraçar você. Seu poder vem do sol. minha medida. Então vem, vamos viver a vida. Então vem, senão não vou perder quem sou. Vou querer me mudar para uma life on Mars. Muitas coisas do coração não consegue compreender, porque a mente não faz questão, nem tem forças pra obedecer. Quantos sonhos já destruí e deixei escapar das mãos. Se o futuro assim permitir, não pretendo viver em vão.
Welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm still Joshua Holland. You know, I wrote this piece for The Nation this week. It was called Islamic Terrorism is Right-Wing Terrorism. Conservatives were very pleased to hear that, as you might imagine. I got a lot of fun in my Twitter mentions. But I made a pretty simple point. All conservative religious traditions have certain things in common. All of them have a disdain for religious pluralism, right? They don't recognize the legitimacy of other faiths. All of them have hostility towards people who don't conform to traditional gender norms, towards LGBT people, towards feminism. Many of them embrace religious nationalism. These are conservative religious traditions. This is true of conservative Christianity, conservative Islam, conservative Judaism, conservative Hinduism. And the reason that I wrote this piece is that I find myself, and I know a lot of people out there have the same instinct, when you hear that somebody has perpetrated a terrible crime, an act of domestic terrorism, you worry about what the perpetrator is going to turn out to be, what kind of person the perpetrator is going to be. You worry that it's going to be a Muslim, because you know that if it's a Muslim shooter, then we're going to have weeks of bigotry towards all Muslims. And you know that that won't be the case if it turns out to be a Christian fundamentalist, if it turns out to be a Robert Deere type who opened fire in a Planned Parenthood clinic in Colorado Springs. You know that that won't be held against Christianity as a whole. And I decided I'm not going to play this game anymore, because the problem is right-wing religious philosophy. And it's the problem with settler violence in the occupied territories, and it's the problem with extremist terrorist, Christian terrorist groups like the Lord's Resistance Army in Central Africa, which is the Christian version of ISIS. They chop off people's heads. They commit horrific atrocities. And it's funny because, you know, in the United States, Muslims are more likely to identify as liberal than the population as a whole. So we associate all of Islam with the most reactionary, the most conservative strains of Islam. And of course, it's true that in all of these religions, most conservative religionists do not commit violence. But nonetheless, there is this common strain throughout them. And to the degree that we're under attack by radical Islam, if you will, it's not liberal Muslims. We're not worried about Unitarians blowing up abortion clinics, and we're not worried about liberal Muslims opening fire in a gay bar in Orlando. Anyway, my next guest is, I believe, what is your title? You're the
contributor to The Nation.
No, the title on this show, you're our Middle East correspondent,
right? Senior Middle East correspondent or something.
Yes. So I'm happy to welcome our senior Middle East correspondent and contributor to The Nation, my colleague of The Nation, Ali Gharib. Ali, thanks for coming on the show.
It's always a pleasure to talk with you, Josh.
Ali, he did a forum for Democracy, a journal of ideas called Islam and Liberalism. He co-moderated a panel with four prominent liberal Muslim Americans. with Mike Tomasky, the editor of Democracy Journal of Ideas, and also a semi-regular on the show. Ollie, tell us about this forum. When did this happen? How did this come together?
It happened about a month and a half ago, and the idea was sort of sparked by something that that Mike had written several months back that I believe was on the tail of some of the San Bernardino attack, and Mike wrote this really controversial column that was like, hey, American Muslims don't want to hear this, but you know, you guys got rights and you got to earn them. And I complained to Mike about it, you know, a little bit and gently on Twitter, because I try not to be an a-hole. And I said, hey, I think this is totally inappropriate. It runs counter-liberalism. Like, nobody has to earn these rights. That's the whole point. And we got into a long discussion about it over email, and it was something that we talked about, and I don't actually know for sure, but I suspect that's why when he dreamed up this idea, all the credit goes to him. He came to me and said, hey, I'm thinking about doing something like this. And he said, who do you think would be good? And he came up with all the other folks, but the one I suggested was Representative Keith Ellison, who I think does very much qualify as a progressive Muslim. I mean, he's the first Muslim member of Congress. And, you know, if you know anything about his voting record, he's a staunch progressive in almost every way. And so we met up. It was myself, Michael, Representative Ellison, another former journalist who's become an activist named Asra Nomani, another a sort of security expert who's a liberal-ish Muslim, but maybe more of a classical liberal-ish Muslim rather than like a progressive left Muslim, whose name is Hassan Abbas. And then there was also a fascinating woman named Ani Sonnenfeld, who runs a progressive Muslim group out in California. And the idea was to find people that were all somewhere on the spectrum of both liberal and Muslim, and get them to chat about what that means and what the obligations were both within their group and outside their group, and how to deal with the extremes of their own faith. And I think it was a pretty fascinating forum, actually.
You know, let me just say this about Mike Tomasky. He is, among pundits, one of the most... He is one of the most accountable pundits out there. When he wrote that piece, I sent him a very sharply worded email, and we did it privately. I did not go on Twitter, but he was very receptive, and I'm happy to see that this was the result. It almost bothered me when I was reading the introduction, though, that he says, you know, people might be shocked to imagine that there's liberals, that there are liberal Muslims. And it seems to be astounding that, you know, this is the second largest religion in the world. There's 1.6 billion Muslims. That's an estimate, of course. And we have Muslim Americans. There are Muslims in Europe. There are some who are struggling to assimilate. There are some who are very well assimilated. Why do you think there is this widespread idea that there's no liberal tradition within Islam, and we don't think that way about other religions? And you know, we accept that when you have a huge number of people who are adherents of a religious faith, of course they're going to have ideological diversity.
Yeah, I mean, why that is, I think, is a function of sort of two media driven phenomena that come together. And the first is that, like, there's a lot kind of sexy in reporting what extremists are doing. And so those tend to be the stories that you hear a lot about. They're the things that they're going to focus on CNN for 48 hours straight. And then the second related phenomenon is media phenomenon is that you're not going to hear that much about ordinary people living ordinary lives. You know, you might get the occasional, 3-minute piece about some liberal Muslim who's running a group like Ani Sonnenfeld type. You know, you might see that on CNN, but you're not going to get wall-to-wall days of coverage because some group held a conference, interfaith conference or something, And Annie Sonnenfeld, in a sense, doesn't even represent the largest group of these Muslims. So as you said in a Nation piece you wrote a few months ago, when was that, the one that you wrote about the about American Muslims?
The truth of about American Muslims. I think that was last year, but yeah, that's
It's titled
The Truth About American Muslims.
Which is a great piece and everybody should read. It's from December of last year. I think you pointed out in that, as you pointed out in your latest piece, that something like 70% of Muslims in the U.S. identify as either liberals or moderates. And, you know, you're not going to hear about most of those people because they aren't going to even be the liberal activists. They're just going to be ordinary people who are doing ordinary jobs. And so I think it's the combination of those two things, the attractiveness of doing the story about the extremes, and also the fact that though most of these people hold... And so that like paints the larger picture where people expect this thing and they never get the countervailing narrative that actually is the vast majority of these people because it's just non-news.
You know, there was an interesting aspect to this, which is that Islam in America, and this is the United States I'm talking about, is the most ethnically diverse of all religions. And the largest group of Muslims are African Americans. They make about a quarter of all Muslims. And it was interesting to see Keith Ellison, again, very progressive African-American. He grew up in a Christian household, and he didn't associate Christianity with the religion of peace. Tell us a little bit about that.
And he says, at an early age, I couldn't square how I and Bull Connor could have the same religion, which strikes me as a totally, totally valid point. I mean, these were people who were... You know, I mean, I suppose you could say the same thing about some of the more infamous violent Muslim extremists, but these were the people that were impacting his everyday life, and they called upon this Christian God, and he just couldn't understand that.
And one of the interesting things is that for African Americans, Islamic movements within African Americans have not been exclusively so, but they have largely been the radical left. Right. I mean, it's interesting that we have this conception of this as this arch conservative religion. But for this one group, and let me point out that 10-15% of African slaves were Muslim. So Muslims have been in this country since before there was a country. And it's often been a religion of revolution, of uprising against oppressors. So you see Keith Ellison have this perspective that, wait a second, Islam is a religion of tolerance and inclusion, and it stands for justice against oppression. And it really flips the script in a way.
Yeah, it really offered him that liberation. And I mean, this was a story we saw, you know, Muhammad Ali obviously recently passed away. And, you know, speaking of Black American Muslims, this is probably the most famous American in the world. And he went through the same thing where he just didn't think that the religion in which he was brought up, which he had no hostility towards, offered him the kind of freedoms and answers that he was seeking. And he turned to Islam. And in fact, that Islam led him into a life of progressive activism. I mean, this is and you know, it's amazing. We're talking here about the, like I said, the most famous American in the world, maybe certainly of the second half of the 20th century, and it's really remarkable to see that.
You see this in the political discourse, this debate over whether Barack Obama should say radical Islam more often. Muhammad Ali was a radical Muslim, and
right.
Hopefully we don't need to bomb those types of radical Muslims who believe in nonviolence, who are not.
Well, as you say, I'm sure there are some right wingers who think we do.
Yeah, I mean, that's clear from the discourse. There's a lot of bigotry out there. It was interesting that a number of your panelists said that they felt that the purest expression of Islam is a progressive expression of Islam.
Yeah, I mean, there's no, you know, and Ellison, for his part, literally cites chapter and verse from the Quran. I mean, he has it memorized. He reads it out, and this is literally his holy book is informing these values that he's voting for every day on the floor of Congress. And, you know, you can see the results are right there in the votes. And when if you looked at his votes and you didn't attach religion to him, you would just say this guy is one of the most progressive members of Congress.
Yes.
And those values that have led to those answers are all coming from his religion in one way or another.
Yeah, it's Ani Zonovald said that, and I'll quote, "The one thing that has moved me to do the work that I do was studying Islam for myself after 9/11 and discovering that it's really rooted in social justice and egalitarianism." There was this critique among your panelists that there's, let me take 2 points in turn. One was that imams in the United States are not as aggressive as they might be, countering some of these conservative traditions that are not rooted in the Quran, in the holy texts, but are quote unquote tribal, remnants of tribal tradition.
Yeah, what you might call cultural.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I mean, this is something that we see, for example, in the debate over female genital mutilation, which I think is fair to say is the farthest thing you might get from a progressive value.
Yes.
And you'll see the sort of most famous Islamophobes always talk about this, and you'll even see some people among liberals in the liberal left who will pin this on Islam, especially feminists. And I think it's sort of mistaken because, as you said, there's so many Muslims. It's an incredibly diverse religion across the globe, and there's Muslims of all sorts of different cultures, and female genital mutilation is largely an East African phenomenon, which they have ported into their religion because religion dominates life for a lot of those people, but it's not actually a religious value. It's a cultural value that they express to their children as a religious one because they express almost everything to their children. But female genital mutilation as a practice doesn't exist anywhere from most parts of the Arabian Peninsula all the way through South Asia. I mean, I think there's one particular tribe in Pakistan that practices female genital mutilation and nothing. And we're talking about like a massively populous Muslim country. And so, I mean, that's how it basically works. It's this cultural practice that comes to be associated for the religion. You know, and I don't think the commentators are solely at fault for this because, as I said, I think that some of the elders in the cultural factions that do practice these sorts of things, that have taken it on from their tribal and cultural roots, do port it into their religion, but that doesn't mean that it actually comes from the religion.
Well, on FGM specifically, I would also add that it correlates far better with that region in Africa than it does with religion, because in that region, you have FGM is a serious problem for Christian girls, for animist girls. There are countries in Africa where you'll see 97% of Christian girls undergoing, that's not an exact number, 90 plus, a huge share of Christian girls suffering from FGM, and a very small share of Muslim girls. So it's not restricted to Islam, and it doesn't correlate well with Islam around the world. But in the forum, we were talking about more domestic issues. FGM is not a big problem in the United States, obviously. Thank God.
Yep.
The thing that came up, I think, was that in order for a Muslim woman to marry a man, he has to convert to Islam. And there was some criticism of this because this is not in the Quran. This is a tradition coming from more recently. There was another theme throughout, which is that, you know, when you look at the big sweep of human history, we talk about Muslim societies right now struggling to enact women's rights. I always find that we look and we say, well, look at these backward societies. They're like stuck in the year 1200. And it's kind of surprising to me. You know, Swiss women were given the right to vote in federal elections in 1971. You know, we don't have laws that guarantee equal pay between men and women. Obviously, we are advanced compared to a lot of Muslim majority countries. But, you know, again, if you look at the history of humanity, being 50 years ahead is not significant. And there is a a robust feminist movement within Islam. You even see this in countries, in repressive countries like Saudi Arabia. There is a feminist movement in Saudi Arabia. So, Ali, let me ask you this. And I think this is a really tricky question when you get down to it. This issue of feminist critique of Islam, right? There is the simple fact that many Muslim-majority countries are behind us in terms of assuring women's rights. Even if it's just 50 years, they're 50 years behind us, and that's not insignificant. And there are some extremely, extraordinarily cruel and abusive practices that are evident in Muslim countries, as well as homophobia, et cetera, et cetera. So on the one hand, you as a liberal, you want to criticize those things. On the other hand, we are aware that Muslims are a beleaguered minority. They face hate crimes and discrimination. There are about a third of the American population think that they are inherently violent. There are about a third of Republican primary voters believe that Islam should be banned. How do you strike that balance?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tricky one. I don't think we should necessarily shy away from it completely. But I do think that it's something that that we have to approach delicately, at least. I mean, I have no problem with, like, Kamel Daoud writing his Times op-ed and being provocative. I think that's totally appropriate. He should, you know, if he has an interesting enough idea that he wants to put in the Times, I trust those editors there on the op-ed page to say, like, this is not an attack against Islam. We're gonna publish this. That doesn't mean you go and publish like patently offensive Charlie Hebdo pieces and Muhammad cartoons, although I would defend those guys' right to do that, but maybe question the wisdom of it. But yeah, the question is really difficult. But, you know, I think that also there's a strain of liberal Muslim activists who have been a lot better actually about talking about these things. I mean, when you see that our panel here, a bunch of these people supported the Kamel Daoud op-ed about sexuality in Islam. And, you know, I went to, and, you know, like, Annie Sonnenfeld is very active about supporting LGBT rights within her own community. So is Keith Ellison. I mean, Keith Ellison is down the line, you know, and he spoke about going into his community, and some of the more conservative members have questions about this, and he says, listen, this is, like, a value that we got to have. We have to look out for other people's rights, too. It can't just be about us. And that was an argument that I heard a South Brooklyn activist named Linda Sarsour, who is sort of a celebrity activist. I have a profile of her coming up in the ACLU magazine. And I went with her into this conservative Muslim organization's this summit that they held at a mosque in New Jersey. And this was a room that had, you know, a few hundred people, a handful of them, maybe two dozen were non-Muslims, were various people that had been invited there. And she said, you know, I'm speaking to you, my brothers and sisters here. I have some things that I want to say. Not everybody's going to be happy with me. And she talked about women's rights, and she talked about LGBT rights, and under this sort of rubric, this, like, famous liberal American line that, you know, quoting Martin Luther King, what's the line? It's an injustice anywhere is
an injustice against one is an injustice against all.
Or, that idea.
Yeah, you get it.
So I do think that it's happening, especially among American liberals. Who, I mean, you know, I don't want to get too nationalist about it, but like there's a privilege that comes with being here, and it's part of what you've talked about, and, you know, that you mentioned in your latest piece and in that December piece that I can't emphasize enough that everybody should read, that, like, the privileges of being this successful demographic group in America give you the opportunity to kind of lead on these things. And I feel like there are some people doing that. Sure, there's a lot of space to be made up, especially when you talk about the global, like, Islam around the world. But I think you also have to remember that a lot of these countries, you're talking about cultural traditions, a lot of them are coming up under, you know, authoritarian governments that way of doing business just always seems to breed the worst instincts in religion. I mean, you look at Egypt, and what happened was that under the kind of iron fist of the military dictatorship, the only place where people could gather was in the mosque, and and that just opened up the room for the conservative Muslims. I mean, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood is basically a right-wing Muslim group. That doesn't mean that I think that they should be slaughtered in the way that, you know, American Islamophobes sort of delighted in happening, but that allows these sorts of groups to get the monopoly, and then all you need is for an organization like the Brotherhood that can organize, can get people together, and then they get the monopoly on political expression, instead of it being a kind of more individualistic or pluralistic society where you have political spheres, where you have religious spheres, and you're just exposed to a lot more because a lot more is allowed to be out there. And these are problems that plague a lot of, you know, certainly not every Muslim country out there in the world is dictatorial, but so many of them are that it's hard to notice. And, you know, I don't, just so people don't accuse me of being a nationalist, I want to take a little bit of a shot here. Like, I think that American imperialism has played a role in that, certainly in the Arabian Peninsula, where we've been after one thing and one thing only, at the expense of this kind of deal that we brokered with the Muslims. I watched this kind of experimental documentary called Bitter Lake that was produced for the BBC. It's really fascinating. It's about Afghanistan and the opium trade, but it talks a lot about the kind of implicit deal that was brokered between the Americans and the Saudis in the 50s that was like, basically, you sell us your oil, and we'll let you do whatever you want inside your country with
and
your
we'll
religion.
Protect you.
We'll let you export
you.
It, and we'll protect you. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's the deal that we have.
We'll send you weapons and make sure that you stay in power. It's important to understand this, that, you know, we look at these Muslim majority countries. We see various abuses, and we say, look, it must be this correlation must have a causal relationship. But if you look at these countries, you see other correlations as well. You see other variables, right? These are countries with the weak rule of law, countries with poor governance, with poor education systems.
And just with, poor.
With economies that are stuck with the so-called resource curse. All sorts of problems with a colonial legacy that left them fragmented and with artificial borders that didn't match the demographics. And if you look at, you know, I think that one of the best evidence that there's nothing inherently wrong with Islam is how successful they are when they are in a country with good governance, with good education systems, with a strong rule of law. You don't see the same types of issues. And I think that's a really important point. One final point, talking about the feminism issue, I have had guests on the show. I wish I remembered her name. I'm bad with names. I had a guest on the show, and she talked about how often for indigenous feminist movements in these countries, it hurts them to see feminism associated with the West. That if they see it as an external means of controlling the population, as something being imposed from without, as opposed to a demand from women in those countries, it is counterproductive to their efforts. Ali Gharib, we are out of time. I want to thank you so much for a really enlightening conversation.
Of course, man. It's totally my pleasure.
I also want to thank David Dayan. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall, H-O-L, or send an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes or Podbean. I'd like to thank Digby and Crooks and Liars for letting us host the show at their joints, their places. And, of course, I'd like to thank all of you good people for tuning in. Have a terrific week. They told me that I never would recover. Still some say they